From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the other effects of tasers.
But first, we begin in Cleveland, where community leaders are working to convince people to keep the peace as a judge there decides a controversial case against a white police officer. Officer Michael Brelo is accused of voluntary manslaughter in the fatal shooting of an unarmed black couple in a car chase 3 years ago. Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson is calling for calm, and he's joined by former NFL player Reggie Rucker of the Cleveland Browns, who now runs the Cleveland Peacemakers Alliance. Reggie, what are you doing to prevent a potential violent outburst when this verdict comes down?
Well, it began yesterday, actually. We'll work with anyone, but we know where the issues are, and the issues are with young black boys and white police officers. That's the issue in America, basically. And we deploy violence interrupters throughout the streets of Cleveland in the what we call the hot spots. And my violence interrupters are not necessarily do you have to be, but typically they are ex-gang members, ex-felons who have turned their lives around. We have vetted them. And what we do is we rely on our street credibility and the relationships that we have with the gang leaders and the shot callers out there. Because in this instance, we want to identify the outsiders who are coming into our community to do and to create and to try to disrupt the normal flow, and we don't want our city burning. We don't want shootings. We don't want innocent people hurt. This Cleveland is different. I grew up in D.C., so I know Baltimore, and those are bigger communities. They have a bigger footprint. Cleveland is a community where we know what's going on in the streets here, and from across the board, my people. There's very little that can happen in this community that we don't know about. We're a big, small community, if you get my drift.
And you're a big figure in that community.
Well, yes. I've been here for 40 years now, 40 years, and this is my home, and I love this place. And also, I love my people. And I'm not ashamed to say that I'm interested in protecting the lives of black people and seeing if they can rise up beyond what we're dealing with.
Well, let me ask you, Reggie, specifically about what you're doing now and how you bring your own credibility and street credibility, in fact, from growing up in a considerable amount of deprivation in Washington, D.C., and how that is influencing your discussions that you're having now.
Well, you've got to be able to understand the language of the street. And then you've got to be able to understand the language of the boardroom with the CEOs and the grantors and all of that stuff. So it takes a particular skill set. And D.C. prepared me for that. Growing up in the projects in Washington, D.C., no father, eight children, three of the brothers died in prison, walking the streets homeless, welfare, and to rise up out of all of that. To be the one that gets out of that condition is my story. And, it's hard for anybody to tell me, you don't know, because I came from that life.
Are they listening?
I think they are. I think it resonates because we're having success. I've sat down with these gang leaders and talk to them. And I point blank ask them, what is it you want? Can you tell me what it is you want? We just want you to stop the shooting. We want to stop the women and the children from being innocent victims of the shootings. We want to call a truce. Can you tell me what you... And I have these gangsters and these gang leaders saying to us, what we see is not fair. We can't get money. We can't get jobs. We don't have access to capital. One of the leaders had a master's degree, sharp guy. He runs 300 men in his gang, and he's responsible for making sure that they get fed and they all the kinds of things that come with food, clothing, and shelter. Now, if a guy can do that on the street, What do you think a guy like that can do in terms of running a company or a business?
How do you balance, then, preventing a riot and silencing what some people would call a justified and necessary protest?
Well, it's a very delicate thing to do. And one of the things, if you've watched the accounts of the Baltimore mayor, the president now has gotten himself into a little bit of hot water by the terminology that people are using. See, he's a black man, but he's not a black man with these experiences. And, you've got to give people an opportunity to protest, which they're going to do. And we invite that as long as you do it peacefully. They were doing it for a while in Baltimore. And things don't happen as quickly as we would like to see them happen. And then as a result of that, what you have is you have this thing brewing and people in the background creating and riling up the emotions of people who are standing by, who are wanting something to happen. And they're on edge. They're on edge, and they're willing to, and they'll do the kinds of things that we saw Monday. But once cooler heads prevail and you calm down the rhetoric and you start speaking to the real issues and you make people aware that we understand what's going on, we're trying to make sure we know who the players are in this community. We're trying to make sure that we know that the clergy is with us. The police and in our community, the police know who the Cleveland Peacemakers Alliance are. They know what we do. And they are willing to let us do what we do because they know no one else in this community has the kind of credibility on the street that the Cleveland Peacemakers Alliance has.
Former NFL player Reggie Rucker, who now runs the Cleveland Peacemakers Alliance. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Well, with the spotlight on police shootings around the country, many police departments are relying more heavily on so-called less than lethal force to subdue suspects. But new research shows that one of the debilitating effects of tasers may be doing an injustice. Jimmy Jenkins from Here Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to the presence of an attorney.
The Miranda warning, that list of rights police officers are required to read to you after they take you into custody. Well, new research has cast some doubt on your ability to fully understand what's being read to you if this happens to you first. That's Chris Hannigan getting tased as a part of his training to become an officer with the Tempe, Arizona Police Department. After catching his breath, he says he's okay, but not everyone recovers from the experience the same way.
I saw a number of individuals cry. There's a very strong emotional response.
Dr. Michael White is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University. He's the lead author of a study published in the journal Applied Cognitive Psychology examining the effects of a taser exposure on cognitive functioning.
We conducted a randomized controlled trial, so it was a very rigorous methodology.
White and his team recruited close to 800 ASU students for the experiment. Some of the students served as a control and were given no treatment, while others were subjected to a 5-second taser exposure. The students were given a battery of mental and physical tests before and after the exposure. While all of the subjects returned to their baseline testing levels within 24 hours, White says in the short term they saw a dramatic change in the students that were tased.
We did document statistically significant declines in cognitive functioning.
These declines lasted for about an hour. White thinks this could have implications for arrestees that waive their Miranda rights and offer a confession during this time of impairment.
In some cases, you could visibly see how people were affected by the taser exposure.
White says aside from being emotionally shaken, participants were unable to repeat back lists of words and displayed significant loss of memory.
Certainly the fact that we're seeing some disruption, that it's temporary, I think raises questions about the reading and waiver of Miranda rights within that one-hour mark.
Jean-Jacques Cabou is a Phoenix-based criminal defense attorney. He says when suspects waive their Miranda rights and offer information to police officers, their waiver must follow certain criteria.
The courts have set forth a standard by which criminal defendants' choice to waive any of their rights is evaluated, and they ask whether the waiver is knowing, whether it's voluntary, and whether it's intelligent.
While Kabu admits there's a high bar to have confessions thrown out, he says the new study could affect how a court interprets a knowing and intelligent waiver.
There are arguments to be made that someone could be pushed below the threshold of intelligence or knowledge as a result of being tased.
Dr. White's team tried to replicate the conditions of a contested arrest by having study participants engage in physical activity before their tasing, but he admits young, healthy college students are not the best sample of the average arrestee. He says the next step will be to try and work with Phoenix area police departments to test cognitive functioning of actual arrestees after they've been tased in the field. But Yale law professor Stephen Duke is skeptical of any Miranda policy changes in the near future.
All sorts of cognitive impairments are commonly present when people are questioned by the police, and it almost never results in the exclusion of their incriminating statements.
So if you're detained, Duke's advice? Invoke your right to remain silent and get a lawyer. For Here and Now, I'm Jimmy Jenkins in Phoenix.
Sounds from the streets of Ho Chi Minh City, what was years ago called Saigon, today, as the Socialist Republic of Vietnam celebrates the end of its war with the U.S., what the Vietnamese call the American War, the war that ended 40 years ago today. And the Vietnamese call this day Reunification Day, the day the last Americans left and the North and South were rejoined. Bob Oakes, from our mothership, Here and Now contributor WBUR, has been in Vietnam all week reporting on this anniversary. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Robin.
And tell us more about, we hear a little of the sound. What was the scene at today's celebration?
Well, it was surely very colorful and very loud. Loudspeakers, blaring, recorded music, and announcements all over the center part of the city. It was a military parade. There was a heavy police presence on the streets. Our producer, Shannon Dooling, was told there were snipers on the rooftops. But you can't say that that kind of security is surprising, because if the U.S. president or the vice president was at a parade in the U.S., there would certainly be tight security, and the Prime Minister of Vietnam was here in Ho Chi Minh City reviewing the marchers and delivering a speech.
Yeah, but Bob, to who? Were there a lot of spectators there?
No, that's the odd thing, Robin. There were just scattered groups of spectators on the sidewalks from what we could see. But in the main viewing area, you needed a card to get in. This was not a parade for the worker. It was a parade for the connected. But it was a television event that was broadcast to the masses.
Well, and you tell us that it went right by the U.S. consulate in Ho Chi Minh City. And the consulate was the U.S. embassy in Saigon. Before Saigon was renamed Ho Chi Minh City, and we remember, of course, all the fraught moments at that embassy in the last moments of the war as the U.S. evacuated. And today, you tell us there was a solemn ceremony there. Tell us about that.
Well, April 30th, 1975 was commemorated, the day the last U.S. Marine guards at the then embassy were evacuated off the roof by helicopter in that famous scene you mentioned that many are familiar with. Just hours after the parade wrapped up outside the consulate's concrete walls inside the U.S. compound, a group of about a dozen of the Marine Guards who were the last men out of Vietnam 40 years ago dedicated a plaque on the consulate grounds to the last two U.S. service members killed on Vietnam soil. They were Marine Corporal Charles McMahon of Woburn, Massachusetts, and Lance Corporal Darwin Judge of Marshalltown, Iowa. While on a security detail, the two were killed simultaneously in a rocket attack on the U.S. airbase a few miles away before dawn on April 29, 1975. The U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, Ted Osius, addressed the retired Marines gathered here, the Marines who actually paid for the plaque and organized this dedication.
In your dignity and your graciousness, in the respect you show to the nation and the people of Vietnam, you send to the whole world the very message that I want to deliver here today as well. Americans remember the past, and we honor it while we look to the future and build on it.
The ceremony was quite moving, Robin, and a couple of the Marines were actually a bit emotional.
Bob, tell us more about that, because this is why you are there. Massachusetts had the first killed in Vietnam and the last killed, and you followed these servicemen back. Is this helping them? I mean, as you well know, we've talked about this. I went to Vietnam in 2002. You know, there's a goosebump that rises on your arms as an American when you step onto the land. And these are people who lost friends there. Has this helped them?
Several of them I know have come back here for a degree of closure. It's specifically the reason that they decided to make this trip at this time. And we talked to a couple of them right after the ceremony today, and one of them gave us the impression that he was ready to move on. But the other, a police officer in Massachusetts named John Galane, said that he was just starting to move on. So varying degrees of closure, Robin.
40 years. And just really, really briefly, Bob, what about the Vietnamese that you got to talk to? I remember when I went, the translator, Kong, who some listeners might remember because we had him on the air quite a bit, at the time he said, you know, 50% of the Vietnamese are under 30. They have no sense of the war, what they call the American War.
It's one of the youngest populations in Asia, which is actually one of the reasons why so many international businesses are trying to move here, and it's part of the reason why this particular city in Vietnam is booming. But beyond that, almost everyone we met has been just exceedingly friendly and polite. And, you know, when we're sitting on the sidewalk and soldiers walk by, they're flashing us the peace sign as if to say the past is forgotten and the present is the present.
Bob Oakes from Here Now Contributor WBUR in Ho Chi Minh City. He's been there all week. We'll link you to his stories at hereandnow.org. Reporting on the end of the war 40 years ago today. Bob, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
And the end of the Vietnam War sent millions of refugees to the U.S., including the ethnic Hmong people from the country of Laos on Vietnam's border. About 60,000 Hmong soldiers were recruited by the CIA to fight during the war. When the fighting ended, they had to flee. Today, more than 250,000 Hmong live here in the U.S., a few thousand of them near Seattle. As Liz Jones from Here and Now contributor KUOW reports, the pain of a lost homeland still hangs over this community.
If you've ever been in Seattle's famous Pike Place Market and bought one of those big flower bouquets, there's a good chance a Hmong farmer sold it to you.
From here on, they're all Hmong farmers. Everybody knows everybody.
That's Bi Cha. He's with Washington State University's Small Farms Program. He's worked with a lot of Hmong farmers here in this market. His family is in the flower business, too.
So this is my farm, Chuneng Cha Farm.
Behind the booth, his sister wraps the flowers into a paper cone. Bi's family came to Seattle when he was 15.
I think my first memory is cold. There's snow everywhere.
Around 100 Hmong families farm in the valleys just east of Seattle. Most grow flowers on a few acres of land. The tradition got started in the early 80s with the help of a nonprofit to train farmers on county-owned land. It was called the Indo-Chinese Farm Project. Most Hmong farmed back in Laos, but the crops were different.
Mainly rice, corn, sugar cane, and that's it. And opium.
Can't do that one here, huh?
No.
Laos and Vietnam share a long border, and Bi says his country got pulled into the Vietnam War in a big way. North Vietnamese forces ran a military supply route through Laos called the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The CIA recruited Hmong soldiers to disrupt it. When North Vietnamese forces took over, Bi's family had to flee their village. For a few years, they hid in the jungles of Laos, then eventually made it to a refugee camp in Thailand. They came to the U.S. as refugees in 1989.
I left behind a community, a sense of belonging. I crave for that.
In his job now, Bi helps train farmers in business and marketing skills. Farmers like Sai and Chu Chang. We meet at the couple's home near Seattle. The Changs got their start farming in the 80s. Over the years, they've helped newer Hmong arrivals learn the ropes, including Bi's mom.
They say, I teach you. You come here, you have to learn something. A daughter is a daughter. A fight is a daughter. That's what I teach her. That's what Bi's mommy come to my farm.
Like Bi's family, the Changs also had to escape Laos when it fell to the North Vietnamese, because Sai worked with the CIA as part of a special guerrilla unit and trained Hmong foot soldiers to fight in the jungle.
How we use the gun, how we use the bomb, and protect ourselves.
He seems eager to tell his war stories.
One time, I will tell you, I was stabbing a bomb. Then they put a bomb inside.
You stepped on a bomb.
Yeah, I stepped on a bomb. But I'm lucky.
Lucky because a heavy rock was in his reach. He carefully laid it on his shoe, like a weight.
I take my feet out and jump in it, and then blow up.
His bravado fades as he starts to remember more.
Sometimes we're angry, you know, because we fight. I got killed, hungry, no food, and people die a lot. That's a really difficult time.
It's estimated up to 40,000 Hmong people died in that war. When U.S. troops withdrew from Laos in 1973, Tsai says many Hmong felt abandoned. Tsai switches to his native language and he interprets.
American left, nobody help us. We tried to leave, but some make it and some didn't make it because they were all killed along the way.
See, I show you over here.
A certificate hangs in the hallway, signed by former Washington Governor Chris Gregoire. It expresses gratitude for Tsai's heroism and bravery as a soldier for the CIA, a small recognition for his effort in the war and his struggle to make a new life here. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Jones in Seattle.
And boxing fans have been waiting for this for years. On Saturday in Las Vegas, Floyd Mayweather Jr. and Manny Pacquiao finally meet in the ring, with comparisons to Ali Frazier and Tyson Holyfield being thrown like left hooks. Mike Pesca is Here Now's sports analyst and host of the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, they're saying this could be one of the greatest bouts in the sports history, and we'll put an end to the question of who's the best. You say what?
Well, I would say that Ring Magazine has released their pound-for-pound rankings. It's a way to compare heavyweights to welterweights to lightweights. And right up there at the top is Floyd Mayweather. He's the best pound-for-pound boxer. He's undefeated. He's been perceived as such for many years. And the last guy to hold that title for a quite extended period of time was Manny Pacquiao. So, yeah, and then you add to the fact that, my God, we thought this fight would never happen, and maybe it's only happening now because both fighters are a little bit diminished from when they were at their heights, but it's certainly the most anticipated. Don't know if it'll go 12. Don't know if it'll live up to the hype. A lot of these fights don't live up to the hype, but it should be a spectacle.
Well, and you listed some of Floyd Mayweather's stats. You can add he has 7 documented assaults against 5 different women. How's that impacting this?
Well, yeah, and also we should note that he was convicted, or he pled guilty to charges of violence against 4 of those women, and it's I think it looms over the fight in a extremely disturbing way, because unlike a lot of other athletes, you know, we went through this with the NFL. It is a layer or 2 layers between the fact that, you know, Greg Hardy or Adrian Peterson did something to either women or a child. What does that mean? What are you supposed to do with that as an NFL fan? Boycott the whole sport? But in this fight, if you pay for the fight, 60% of the purse is going right to Floyd Mayweather.
I should ask you about that, just so people know. I mean, there's a guaranteed purse, 60% to Mayweather, 40%, I think, to Pacquiao, estimated $300, something like that, million-dollar purse. What's the incentive if they already have a guaranteed purse?
Well, this is the only reason that they did it is because they're getting so much money and because people will still be able to make a profit. I mean, Las Vegas will be booking more bets on this than any single event other than the Super Bowl. I want to say that USA Today had a good article today where they said, where can your $99 that you might have spent on the fight go? And they said that $99 is the cost for one night in a Women Against Abuse Domestic Violence safe haven. They had a couple of other ways you could give to a charity, or split it 50-50. 50 goes to the fight, you pool it with a friend. 50 goes to an anti-violence against women charity. Manny Pacquiao is using it as motivation. It's a little too simple to say this is good versus evil. Pacquiao, though an elected official in the Philippines, also has some demerits on his record. Let's just say, though, that he is more in the camp of nobody's perfect, whereas Floyd Mayweather is unrepentant and won't even give lip service, the kind of lip service that you would think that a highly paid athlete would think to give
to some of these other causes. Well, just a few seconds left here. So this, you know, all this money, even though people were saying what boxing was waning, just briefly, what's the state of boxing? It doesn't seem, there's a lot of money here.
Yeah, you know, though, I think this is the fight of the century. It could also be the last big fight that we ever see. It has a fin de siècle feel about it. MMA is taking the popularity of boxing. Just how hard this fight was to pull off shows a lot of the things that are wrong with it. And the popularity of Mayweather probably does, too.
Well, Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, and the only sports announcer to use fin de siècle in his
I hope reporting. I pronounced it right.
Close. Mike, good enough. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What are the deeper discussions that have to come out of Baltimore? Here's President Obama.
We can't just leave this to the police. I think there are police departments that have to do some soul searching. I think there's some communities that have to do some soul searching. But I think we as a country have to do some soul searching.
Today, Jonathan Capehart writes in The Washington Post, you can draw a straight line from Baltimore to Los Angeles 1992, when that city erupted after Rodney King was beaten viciously by five white police officers after a car chase and four were acquitted. And our next guest writes today in Newsweek that you need to go back further than that, to the 1960s. Peniel Joseph is professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts. Peniel, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And you write that you're reminded of the upcoming 50th anniversary of the 1965 Watts Rebellion in Los Angeles. Remind us what happened then.
Well, this occurred 5 days after the passage of the Voting Rights, after Lyndon Johnson signed it on August 6, 1965. And there's a confrontation between an African-American motorist and police that really is going to erupt into a week-long uprising or riot or civil disturbance. 34 people dead, millions in damage, so many arrests. And what's interesting about that is that Dr. King is going to go into Watts and he's going to be heckled. He's going to be preaching nonviolence. And King really is going to mark that visit to Watts as his push for economic justice.
Yeah, because he was seeing that people were losing his message. They didn't feel that they could hang on peacefully.
Yeah, he saw that civil rights without economic justice wasn't going to be enough, because what was going on in Watts was a combination of poverty, lack of resources, and then institutional racism vis-a-vis not just the police, but Watts was just like Ferguson, just like what we're seeing in Baltimore, at least sections where you didn't have good supermarkets, you didn't have good resources, you didn't have good schools.
Right. So the national conversation starts and it increases because in 67, Detroit and Newark went up in flames. Again, violence there sparked by accusations of policing tactics. Then the riots in 1968 after the Martin Luther King assassination. And the country did seem to be on a track to have a discussion about institutional racism. But then you say in this article that you've written in Newsweek, and we'll link people to it, and there are many who agree with you with the next point you make, is that that conversation about institutional racism got derailed and the blame was shifted to a problem within the black culture, specifically because of a report that came out. Let's just take a minute to talk about this 1965 report from then Assistant Labor Secretary Daniel Patrick Moynihan. It was called The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. You're on the side of those who say that in pointing out the number of single mom-headed black families, it blamed them. Now, others, as you know, disagree. Just want to play a little sound. Here's Harvard University sociology professor Orlando Patterson. We spoke to him just last month about this. He says Moynihan was misinterpreted and also was ultimately right. Let's listen.
Moynihan was in many ways speaking from his own experience. He grew up with a single mom in a low-class Irish area.
But at the time, this pointing out the number of black families headed by single moms was seen as victim-blaming.
That's right. It came at the wrong time. The civil rights movement was shifting, moving towards racial pride.
Black power.
Black power. Mm. What he predicted turned out to be far worse than what he saw. We now have a situation where over 73% of kids are being born to single parents. And the sociological evidence on this is just irrefutable.
Peniel Joseph, weigh in on this debate, institutional racism versus a cultural problem.
Well, institutional racism really shatters families. So the criminal justice system, as we've seen, has resulted in 1.5 million black men missing from American civil society. New York Times did a story about that. Mm. And Hillary Clinton just cited it. So we're really saying what Moynihan was really should have been talking about was poverty and a lack of resources. And even in the 1960s, the over-criminalization of black men and women that was actually going on, but not at the numbers that we see. So institutions can either help families, provide resources, provide child care and daycare and safe schools and good communities and employment, or they can be these sort of desperate, economically deprived, racially segregated places that we want to wall ourselves up against, away from.
So you're saying it's not as if black men didn't want to be members of the family. They weren't there. They had been arrested. They were taken out of the picture. And by the way, we should add, people credit Moynihan with being the one who pushed for jobs for black men. He was a major force in the war on poverty. But putting aside that debate over that moment in history, you say it shifted the conversation again from trying to do something about institutional racism to blaming the black family. And right after that moment in history came the war on drugs and what's been called the new Jim Crow. The effects of that?
Well, the new Jim Crow is this idea that there's a new racial caste system. So in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act of the 1960s, what you have is an increase in the mass incarceration of predominantly African Americans. So you go from 350,000 in prison to 2.1 million. But Robin, what's so important here is that this whole idea of the new Jim Crow is the way in which it stigmatizes African American men and women and really creates further obstacles and barriers to both opportunities, outcomes, and citizenship. So you have men who are fleeing police because of warrants, who can't pay child support, who can't pay high court costs. So we have this whole system, and we see it in Baltimore, where so many of these neighborhoods have been economically devastated, and yes, culturally devastated as well, but the cultural is connected to the right. criminal justice system.
Right. And the phrase New Jim Crow, by the way, legal scholar Michelle Alexander coined it for her 2010 book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, arguing the same thing. But we also had Matt Taibbi, writing, a white reporter, writing an entire book saying the same thing. And then, as you mentioned, Hillary Clinton in her speech yesterday, essentially embracing it as gospel. So I guess the question to you is the national conversation getting back on the track that it was headed towards in the 60s, looking at institutional racism?
Well, I think it is now because of Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, what we saw with Eric Garner, and now Baltimore. And I think the fact that you have a major person like Hillary Clinton endorsing the work of people like Michelle Alexander is extraordinarily important. And really, I listened to Hillary's speech, and what was extraordinary about it was the specifics of it. She was very, very specific policy-wise, talking about the number of African-American men who are going to be on prison, parole, probation, saying that we have to talk about hard truths about race and justice. So the fact that she's saying this as her first policy speech at Columbia was very, very important.
Well, but is there still a conversation that has to be had within the black community, even if the issues are can't be separated from disenfranchisement and the criminal justice system and the lack of employment? Is there a conversation that has to happen? We saw the mother in Baltimore who ran and, you know, the woman dressed in yellow who grabbed her son practically by the ear and pulled him out of the rioting. Is there a discussion that has to happen about the role of the family?
I agree with that. What that Baltimore mother did was important. It's just been utilized by conservatives as if that is the antidote to the violence that we saw in Baltimore, and it's not. I think we need a conversation about how can we help poor black families get resources to have different hopes and dreams and structures in their lives where they're not thinking about crime, but they're thinking about literacy. They're thinking about turning these poor black neighborhoods that we sometimes call ghettos into these real paradises of learning, of investment. If we can do that, that's the conversation we need to have. Because I don't think it's inherently something wrong with poor people. I just think that poor people don't have the opportunities that many of us, including the listeners here, enjoy and really take for granted.
Peniel Joseph, professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. Fascinating as always. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Robin.
And by the way, Peniel also told us he's saddened that Baltimore mom Toya Graham is being lauded when she beat her son. Peniel says upper middle class families don't hit their kids. They know it ultimately makes the kids feel less safe. It's violent. He also said Toya is a product of her environment. But we wondered if wealthier families have the luxury of not cuffing their kids because they don't have the fears that Toya has. We'll post the video of Toya and her son at hereandnow.org, and your thoughts are welcome there as well.
Tyson Foods is the largest chicken producer in the country, and it made a big announcement this week. It said it's going to stop using antibiotics, also used in humans, by September of 2017. This follows McDonald's announcement in March that over the next 2 years, it's going to stop serving chicken raised with human antibiotics. We want to know what's leading to these changes in doing business. Tamar Haspel writes about the intersection of food and science in the Unearthed column in the Washington Post. Tamar, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What does Tyson Foods, Inc. do now regarding the rearing of its poultry, and what's it going to do differently?
What they do now is pretty much conventional practices in the industry, which includes the use of antibiotics. Sometimes some companies use antibiotics to promote growth, but often they use antibiotics, subtherapeutic levels of antibiotics, to prevent disease as well. It's a fine line. And what Tyson has said they're going to do is phase out completely the use of the antibiotics that are used in humans. There are still antibiotics that are used in animals that they will use.
And so why is it making this move?
Probably for a combination of reasons. One reason is that the FDA has recently issued guidance to industry asking for antibiotic makers to remove the growth promotion purpose from their labels, which would make it technically illegal to use antibiotics for growth promotion. But again, because it's a fine line that antibiotics do kill bacteria, so it can be used to prevent disease. Another big issue is consumer pressure. We're seeing a lot of consumer pressure across the board on food. We're seeing it on GMOs, we're seeing it on additives, and we're seeing it on antibiotics as well. And Tyson isn't the first company to respond. Purdue announced that they would aggressively reduce antibiotics last year. And we see other companies responding to other issues. Chipotle just announced that they were going to remove GMOs from some of their offerings. And consumers seem increasingly interested in the source and the content of their food.
Now, that's interesting. By the way, when you talk about GMOs, that's genetically modified organisms. When you talk about the pressure that these companies are feeling from consumers, they've been feeling pressure from the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, for something like 45 years now, because it was that long ago that the FDA first encouraged companies to stop using antibiotics to accelerate the growth of, say, chickens. So how effective has the FDA been compared to consumer pressure?
I think it's hard to say whether one is more effective than the other, but what we have now is a combination of the two, which I don't think we've ever seen on this issue before. It was in 2009 that the FDA first came out and took a stand on this issue, a firm stand, although, as you say, it started back in the 70s. But that's about the same time that consumers started to really be interested in this issue, that antibiotic resistance became something that we see in the news. And so it really is, I think, the 1-2 punch of the FDA and the consumer expressing concern about this. And in some ways, this is some of these companies maybe making a virtue of necessity. They are afraid that more stringent regulations may be coming down the pike, and if they can get ahead of it, it's a good PR move as well as a good move for public health.
And why is the FDA concerned about this at all? I mean, when a chicken or even a cow or a pig is ingesting antibiotics that are used on humans, and part of that livestock makes it to our dinner plate, we consume it, mm-hmm. Does it make us more resistant to antibiotics?
No, that's not the way that the public health problem works, because there aren't antibiotics in the meat itself. Any antibiotics that are fed to animals are cleared from those animals' systems before that meat gets to your table. But the issue is that every time you administer antibiotics, those bacteria have a chance to develop resistance to it. So when antibiotics are administered over and over at subtherapeutic levels, you get the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria on the farm.
So you're saying that if bacteria are flourishing on the farm, then that's going to cause problems for humans no matter what.
Down the line, yeah, yeah. Because there are all kinds of ways that bacteria can get out of the barnyard and into places where humans are more likely to be found.
Does this seem to be a particularly fertile period for change in the food production industry, both with, say, Tyson and Purdue and McDonald's announcement in March that it's going to stop serving chicken raised with human antibiotics, and also in the practices of people who eat meat? I mean, it seems like it's an especially transformative time.
I think it is. I think people are starting to pay a lot of attention, not just to their meat, but to their food in general. And they're pressuring companies to reformulate products and to adopt different kinds of practices. And we see all kinds of companies responding in different ways, from Whole Foods, which has codified standards for animal welfare, and other markets are beginning to step in and do the same thing. And in a lot of ways, consumer pressure, I think, is one of the key drivers of some of these improvements in our food system.
Tamara Haspel writes about the intersection of food and science in the Unearthed column in the Washington Post. We spoke to her about Tyson Foods' announcement that in 2 years it's going to stop using human antibiotics in its chicken flocks. Nice to speak with you, Tamara.
Thanks, Lisa.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.